Extension number 8736, rule number 26.
Lord Harding, tape 26. I believe you had a visit from Tito about this time, Lord Harding, did you not?
Well, it was when we were still, the headquarters was still at Lake Bolsena. And we knew that, because we had been involved in, and when we knew a good deal about the operations or the logistics support and air support that was being given to the Yugoslav partisan movement and activities. And we heard that Tito had come over and was on a visit to Allied Force Headquarters, General Wilson and his staff. And the amusing story told about that time was that at the big dinner party given for Tito, he had a bodyguard with his Tommy gun standing behind him at the dinner table, and an Italian waiter with a large soup tureen walked in for the first course, and the bodyguard with his Tommy gun lowered his Tommy gun straight at the Italian waiter, who promptly dropped the soup tureen, and that was that. However, that was just the story we heard. How we were told Alexander wished, of course, to see him, primarily to discuss how we would work together when we got up into northeast Italy and met up with Yugoslavs. And so it was arranged that he should come up and have a meeting and discussion and lunch with Alexander at our headquarters at Lake Bolsena. And he was to fly up with Fitzroy MacLean, who was then his leading liaison officer. And they were due to arrive, and I sent an ADC to meet them. And they arrived rather early, the turbo or something like that, and came across to our headquarters, and the ADC with Fitzroy MacLean and the marshal and his bodyguard and a woman that he had with him, a partisan woman dressed in uniform. And they arrived outside my caravan while I was still at work, rather earlier than I expected. So the marshal, Tito, was looking very pale and wan, and Fitzroy said, "Well, you had a rather, we came through a thunderstorm, we've had a bad air trip, the marshal's not feeling very well, can he rest on your bed?" So I said, "Yes, of course. Wait a minute while I get rid of my papers." And so I had an orderly, and I packed up what I had, papers and that sort of thing, and gave them to him to take away. And the Marshal Tito and his bodyguard came into my caravan and lay down on the bed. And I said to Fitzroy, "Well, you better come up to the mess, up the hill of the mess, to have a drink before lunch." Halfway up, I remembered that I had left my watch on my desk. So I said to Fitzroy, "I left my watch on my desk. I'm not going to let that thug have it." So he said, "Well, I'd be awfully careful if I were you, how you walk into the caravan." So I said, "Well, I don't care. You're going to have my watch." So I went back and walked in Bella's brass, and the bodyguard lowered his Tommy gun, but I picked up my watch and walked out, and nothing happened. Well, then we had lunch. And then we had, after lunch, the marshal recovered. Then we had a meeting, sitting together under an olive tree. I can see it all now, on the shores of Lake Bolsena, with Alexander and Tito and Fitzroy MacLean and myself. And I think this girl who interpreted for Tito was there. And they discussed what would happen when we got, as we hoped to do, quite fairly, not too long ahead, to get up into northeast Italy and to the chest and join up with the Yugoslav partisans prior to an advance into the Danube Basin. And we discussed arrangements, And we agreed. Alexander made the point that, of course, at that stage, it would be very important from our point of view to open up and develop the port of Trieste in order to maintain supplies to our forces in the Danube Basin, in Austria and the Danube Basin. And this was generally agreed as being the right thing to do. And I think they agreed, didn't they, that they would cooperate and work together closely and harmoniously. When they did, then there would be no conflict of interest or so on. And the actual eventual or the final territorial rights in that part, in the Venezia Giulia and the Trieste, which would be very much in conflict, as a matter of conflict between Yugoslavia and Italy before the war and during the war. I don't think we didn't really touch on that, because that we regarded as a political matter to be settled by politicians and so on. But after the meeting, I said to Alexander, I think you ought to get something put down in writing about what has been agreed, about the way in which we will work together, and about the opening up and development of the port of Trieste and the communications northwards into Austria from there. That is our function and responsibility. And he said, oh, no, I don't think we need bother about that, John, because he regarded Tito at that time, this is my impression, he regarded Tito as another professional military commander. He didn't really think of him in terms of a political leader. And he thought that what they'd agreed verbally between them would hold, regardless of political considerations and events. And this led to difficulties later on, and eventually led, of course, to a problem over the actual sovereignty and possession over the Trieste port and area, and that part of Venezia Giulia. But that, I think, and that, I think, to some extent, explains Alexander's position later on over this controversial question of the repatriation of Yugoslavs who were in occupied, British occupied area, particularly was entirely in Austria, which is now being a matter of great controversy. I think at the time, and this was pretty general, I think, Alexander and I think I personally too thought that after when the war ended that the Yugoslavs and indeed the Russians could be expected to behave and conduct themselves in a rational, reasonable, realistic way, and that they and this I think was the thinking behind Alexander's decision when he agreed to pass on the instructions he got from London that these Yugoslavs, the Chetniks, and so on, were to be repatriated to Yugoslavia and indeed to Russia. It does, may not justify it, but I think it does explain it.
Fitzroy Maclean, what was he there for? What was his role? I wonder that well, he didn't advise
him. Fitzroy Maclean had been sent by the Prime Minister to Yugoslavia to be the chief liaison officer with Tito when it was decided in London that the policy would be to support Tito and the Communist partisans and not Mihailovic and the so-called royalist or loyalist Yugoslav partisans. And Fitzroy Maclean and indeed Randolph Churchill was there too, were attached to Tito's headquarters, and Fitzroy Maclean was the principal, the leader of the British mission to the Yugoslavs. That was from, 1944 onwards. And therefore, he was the chap who held Tito's hand and who made all the recommendations and the advice about what support should be given, how it should be done, and so on.
But
to
the
Yugoslavs.
Did he not attempt to put you in the picture politically regarding Tito at this meeting you had, from what you can remember?
Well, I don't think so. No, I think, I mean, we were talking at that particular meeting, we were talking on purely on a military side. Alexander was not really primarily concerned with the... This all cropped up later.
What did you think of Tito?
Very impressed with him at that time. At being a man of courage and character. I got to know him much better later on. But no, I mean, he was an obviously a leader of considerable importance. And we didn't know much about the details of the operations of the Italian Yugoslav partisans. But they were. It was obviously a tremendous factor in our thinking about our own plans, because the more successful the Yugoslav partisans were in their operations against the Germans occupying Yugoslavia, the better it was from our point of view. We did foresee problems when we met together, because there's always a problem when armies of different nationalities meet and then have to work together, and God Almighty, it did turn out to be a very severe problem.
Yes, and of course you were involved with that,
weren't
you?
I was involved with it later on, when I was in command in Trieste.
Yes, I must ask you about that later on. Did you have any visits from Russians at any stage?
Well, we had a message from Allied Force Headquarters to say that the Russian commissioner, or whatever he was called, in Rome, and his staff wanted to come up on a visit. And so Alexander said, well, of course. Alexander knew something about the Russians. He'd been with the... after the First World War, he'd been with the White Russians in Latvia or Lithuania, one of those places. And so he reckoned he knew something about them. And so he said, all right, delighted to see them. Let them come up and have a meeting and stay the night. And we give them dinner and so on. So a tent was, or a couple of tents were prepared for their reception, and everything was arranged. Beds were put there, and they came and they had dinner, and then they went off to their tents. And they said, all right, well, we'll see you for breakfast in the morning. Well, come the morning, they didn't appear. And so an ADC or someone was sent to have a look and see what had happened to them. And all he found was a note written on a bit of bumf to say that the Yugoslav commissioner, whatever he was called, had decided that he had important business in Rome, and they'd left and gone back to Rome. So that was that. On another occasion, again, I think this illustrates Alexander's attitudes to life in a way. Another occasion, later on, I think it was, a couple of Russian generals who were due to come and have lunch with Alexander and talk with him. It was a good deal later on, when we were further up in Italy. Well, we waited for them, and they didn't arrive, and they didn't arrive. And so Alexander said, well, we better start lunch. And we were about halfway through lunch when the Russian delegation, about four of them, I suppose, a couple of generals and so on, arrived. And they said they were very sorry for arriving so late, but they had lost their way. So all Alexander said was, well, didn't you have a map? On another occasion, they came to a meal at Caserta, some of them. And Rupert Clark was one of Alexander's ADCs. He'd been in the Irish Guards. He was an Irish-Australian by origin, a very good chap. He was particularly interested in revolvers. So the Russian delegation arrived for lunch, and they hung up their greatcoats in the hall at the little house we had there. And I found out afterwards that Rupert had gone through their pockets to see what kind of revolvers they had. I satisfied myself that he hadn't pinched any of them. So that was that. But those are the sort of incidents that happen in war, you know. And they add the lighter side of life to it.
Tito's girl.
Called Olga. She was a very good-looking girl, had rather untidy hair, and she would have been terribly attractive if she hadn't had a grenade tucked under each breast. But she was Tito's interpreter. And later on, two years later, I was in Yugoslavia as a guest of Tito in Yugoslavia. And it was that time that he said to me, you know, after the war, we had to tell our women partisans they'd better get out of uniform and put on their frillies because they weren't getting married.
That's rather a sexist comment of Tito's, isn't it? Could I ask you now about the operations during the autumn and winter of 1944? Because I believe these were quite important.
By the late autumn of 1944, we had pushed the Germans back to what's called the Gothic Line. We were behind the clock as far as my planning had went because of the various withdrawals that we'd had to put up with. And so we were faced with the problem of trying to force our way across over the Apennines and into the Po Valley in the winter. And the Fifth Army struggled hard away with this for some time. And then they did bog down, and it was clear that we weren't going to break through the Gothic Line and into the Po Valley in the winter. And so the problem then was to sit down and prepare a plan to continue the offensive. Continual pressure on the Germans during the winter, but to resume a full-scale offensive in the spring, or as soon as the weather permitted. That was decided to do that by a major offensive on the east coast. And I had been given command of the 13th Corps. I had been relieved of command of the 8th Corps to go to be Chief of Staff to Alexander, and he had told me that he would do his best to make sure that I got a command again before the end of the war. And so, in one way or another, the situation developed in such a way that I was given the command of the 13th Corps when they were one of the corps facing the Germans on the Gothic Line. And we were busy keeping them occupied, active, probing, and reconnoitering with a view to a final offensive. And that took place with the main thrust of being on the east coast by the 8th Army, across the difficult country, the marshes and the ponds and so on that are there. And my corps was on the left flank of that advance, and we got through the Apennines into the Po Valley and then advanced on the left of the 8th Army flank up to and closed up to the River Po. It was during that time that I had an interesting interlude in my relationships with Anders, because once we started, we got into the Po Valley, I was there had some problems which I wanted to fix up with Anders, who was I was next door to the Polish Corps. So I set off one day to go and see him at his headquarters. And on the way there, I met a chap called Lubomirsky, who was one of his personal staff, so I stopped and asked him whether I was on the right, and I got the right map reference to his corps headquarters, and he said, oh yes. So, but I wouldn't go there if I were you. I said, oh, but I must. I've got some business that I must settle with your general. He said, no, no, if I were you, I wouldn't go there. I said, but why? He said, they're all in a state of high emotion. After all, they'd just broken through the Apennines. They were in the Po Valley. They were all very excited and so on. So I said, anyway, I must go. And when I went along and I found headquarters and I located Anders, but then I understood what he meant. Because when I went into their operation room, tent, or whatever it was, I can't remember, it was like they were all talking at the top of their voices and shouting at each other. So I got Anders outside and talked to him, and then we were able to settle our business. But it was rather typical of the problems which the Polish Corps, and indeed the Polish people, had to face of their tremendous emotional disturbance that they suffer from when there is a crisis or when there is an excitement of any kind. Anyway, so we agreed on a plan, and I, for my corps, consisted then of 6th Armored Division on the right and the New Zealand Division on the left. And I also had the 8th Indian Division in reserve. And they formed up to the Po, which the Germans were holding the north bank of. And I went up to see them. And I saw, talked first of all to Nat Murray, who was commanding 6th Armored Division, and agreed with him that he would do an assault over the Po that night, and with a view to forming a bridgehead north of the Po, preparatory to a further advance northeastwards. And on my way back, I knew that Bernard Freiberg was there too, and we agreed what the general plan. On my way back, I ran into Dick McCreary, the army commander, who told me that the information was that the Germans were pulling out fast and hard, and so I must press on, hard as I could go. So when I got back to my headquarters, I'd already told Murray, 6th Armored Division, to get a bridgehead over the Po that night, and I'd try and collect enough bridging to support them in the morning. And so I got on to Bernard Freiberg on the telephone, and I told him this latest information that I had about the Germans pulling out, and I said to him, well, I know you were on the left of the wheel and you came up on the Po and you hadn't had much time or very little time for reconnaissance and so on, but if you could establish a brigade group bridgehead over the Po tonight, and I think we can provide you with enough assault bridging to do it, it would be marvelous. I said, I've ordered the 6th Armored Division to do the same, but if you could do so too, it would be wonderful. And then we could get straight ahead on a two-divisional front. And he said, well, it's a very hazardous operation. I'd had a lot to do with Bernard. I was a great friend of his, and he was a great friend, and I was a great confidant in him. So I said, oh, well, the army commander told me the Germans are pulling out and so on. That's all the information. He said, oh, well, Don, it's a very hazardous operation. I said, well, I've ordered 6th Armored Division to do this, but I'm not ordering you because I know you haven't had so much time for reconnaissance and making plans and so on. But if you could, that'd be marvelous. So I put down the telephone receiver and I said to my chief of staff, I'll lay you £5 of brass farthing that the New Zealanders will have a brigade group bridgehead north of the Pearl by first light in the morning, and of course they did. If I'd ordered him to do so, he mightn't have responded. So, I mean, this is another example of what you do with your various commanders. You judge their personalities, their attitude, where doing their job, and so on. So I quote that merely as an example. We crossed the Pearl. We advanced very rapidly. We had very little resistance. I think on the Yazaji we had quite a tough, short fight before we drove the Germans off and crossed the river. And eventually we found ourselves on the outskirts of Trieste, over the Isonzo River on the outskirts of Trieste. And then problems arose because the Yugoslavs, by that time, the partisans had come into Trieste from the other side, from the east. And so for the next 6 weeks or so, or more perhaps, my leading troops and the Yugoslav partisans were all mixed up together. And I was very anxious and worried about what would happen, whether they would, whether there would be a flare-up because of their conflicting interests and their conflicting attitudes. However, fortunately, all went well, and then eventually they set up a meeting at my headquarters in Trieste, or outside Trieste, at a place called Castelladuino, where we had a week's talking with the Yugoslavs, and eventually we agreed on a boundary line called the Morgan Line. General Morgan, who was then chief of staff to the commander-in-chief in Italy, actually presided over the conference. And we eventually agreed on a boundary line between our forces, and we included the greater part of Trieste, Gorizia, then running up to the Austrian border. And that turned out, that worked out satisfactorily. It led to subsequent troubles. We had agreed to there being a Yugoslav detachment of 2,000 strong inside our frontier, as a sign of significance of the Yugoslav interests in that part of the world and that in that area. And so we settled down then to not too cozy or comfortable coexistence with the Yugoslavs across the Morgan Line, and an attempt to reopen and develop the port of Trieste, the communications from the Mediterranean up to Austria in order to supply our troops there. And problems of military government, of policing the area, of raising the Italian police had really disintegrated, so we had to raise a new police force, which was eventually called the, I used the military police to start with, for all ordinary policing duties, and then we built up a local police force, which was called the Vinita Dula Police. And that was a situation of an uneasy relationship, but no actual conflict, no exchange of arms or anything like that between us and the Yugoslavs until, good long time later, several years later, political agreement was finally reached about the frontier between Italy and Yugoslavia. And the problem from a military point of view ceased to exist. I had a lot of dealings with the Yugoslavs on one occasion.
Yes, I must ask you about the post-war situation in greater depth, Lord Hardinge.